Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome back to The Prospect Interview, where we speak to the brightest minds and talk about the ideas that matter in politics, arts and society. I'm Sarah, and while I'm usually the producer on this podcast, today I'm sitting in the host seat to talk to David Renton, a leading legal aid housing and employment barrister and author of Jobs and Homes, a new book that documents the view from the front line of the housing crisis. Representing clients in courtrooms, both physical and virtual, during the pandemic. While we bunkered down into our homes, David was fighting to stop a panoply of clients from losing theirs, from Ronald, a 70-year-old who once worked with Sid James and was struggling with alcoholism, to Mr. Vogel, who, suffering from PTSD, was facing court because the involuntary cries he made in the night were waking up his neighbours. As reviewer for Prospect Anna Minton says, Renton highlights the human stories that he encounters on a daily basis. Zooming out from the day-to-day life of in county courtrooms across London, David Renton has big and sometimes pretty radical ideas about reforming housing policy in the UK and on ensuring that everybody has access to justice. So David, thank you so much for joining us today. I just wanted to start by asking, what is the housing crisis to you and what made you decide to be drawn into this world of tackling the housing crisis frontline?
Well, look, for me, how I came into it, it's really very simple. I'm a barrister. It's what I do for a living. I could have done immigration law, I could have done crime. It just so happened that I do housing and employment. So that means I represent workers and I represent tenants. As for what the housing crisis is, I guess it boils down to this. There are just way more people who need housing than there are spare houses. Now, we can go into why that happens, but for the moment, let's not worry about the why. Let's just worry about the what. The practical reality is that people are spending more of their money on rent. And particularly since COVID, lots of people can't afford their rent and they're absolutely terrified about losing their homes.
During the course of your new book, you introduce us to loads of really human stories that kind of illustrate how this crisis is affecting people in the courts, including that of Ronald, who faced eviction because of his barking bull terrier, Guinness. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about Ronald's story?
Yeah, sure. Look, the first thing to say about Ronald is that when I came across him, he's actually quite elderly. What I loved about him was his whole life, how he'd got to be there. He'd lived in South Africa. He'd been friends with Sid James from the Carry On films. He'd come over to England and over many, many years, he'd been in the same flat until eventually he was threatened with losing it. There is a bit of sadness in this story. He had a dog, Guinness, and you say Guinness was barking at night and just causing chaos for all the other tenants. But basically, Ronald was saying, I can't let go of Guinness because sometime earlier, about 10 years before, he'd lost his own son as an adult, aged about 18. He died in a road accident. So as far as he's concerned, he couldn't lose his dog. He couldn't have another bereavement. So he was more willing to lose his home, go out and sleep rough, even though he was quite old. And that would have been, you know, a real threat to his life. He was even willing to do that rather than give up his dog. So we came before the courts and it started off and we won some of the cases. One of the great ones involved his solicitor, Sue, who was so determined to get Guinness out of the flat that she was willing to abide by a court order that she would take Guinness. What that meant is if she didn't take Guinness out of the flat, she could have lost, she had to go back before the judge explained herself. She could have been sent to jail if she'd failed to do that. So that was a big thing. she was willing to do. And we bought Ronald more time that way by getting Guinness out for a bit of time. Unfortunately, Guinness came back, and that's really the case where I talk about in the book, because the practical reality was we put all the arguments to the judge. We said Ronald should be entitled to stay in his home, but the judge said no, evicted Ronald, and he actually died relatively soon afterwards. So that's what I talk about in the book. If you'll allow me to just add a very short coda. Now that I've started talking about the case, I'm going around, I did a meeting with Sue there, and she came on and said, you know, look, more happened after you described in the book. She went to Ronald's funeral, and she actually met the neighbour who'd been making complaints about Ronald McGuinness, which had called Ronald to lose his home. So the neighbour went to Ronald's funeral. But the extraordinary thing, she wasn't guilty or embarrassed or ashamed. You know, her complaints had led this dog. Actually, oh, look, Guinness was a great dog. He always got on with my dog. What on earth? And she said, I just never understood why he didn't get to see a lawyer. Because obviously, if he had a lawyer, he would have fought the case and there would have been no problem. He'd have stayed. And it's just like, wow. And maybe that's a kind of bit of a hint into one of the big themes of my book, which is that in housing situations, everyone's got to have integrity. Lawyers have to have integrity. Judges have to have integrity. Sometimes even fellow tenants have to have integrity and be honest with themselves about what they're doing.
That's really interesting. And on the theme of another really memorable tenant from the book, you were talking about how there's kind of, you fear that the rise of remote courts and remote hearings due to the coronavirus pandemic can actually widen the justice gap and kind of widen the distance between the person who is there trying to defend their home and the judge who is already existing in this highly legal, you know, technical world. And one of the cases that really illustrates that, I think, was that of your client, Mr. Curlew, who barely got a few words into his hearing before he was muted by the judge. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about that hearing?
Yeah, look, those sorts of things happen the whole time. When the pandemic started, everything went online, and it wasn't just courts. You know, I'm sure people listening to this will be people in their offices who remember all the Zoom meetings they went to. Well, we had Microsoft Teams, bless us. And it's not been a great platform, and it's caused all sorts of problems. But the fundamental problem is a lot of the people I represent really just have very little indeed. They're not people who've got computers or laptops in their own homes. With the Curlews, a lot of the case was about their young teenage son who'd been a bit of a tearaway, although thankfully his behaviour had really improved. But when the family started sitting down saying, right, well, you'll be the barrister and you'll be engaged in the hearing, so you've got to have a screen. I mean, I remember talking to Mr. Curlew, and basically the only way he could imagine being able to hear this court hearing and having quiet was if he went out of his home, connected up his phone to his car, played the court hearing over the internal car speakers. I mean, what sort of privacy does that give him when anyone can walk past and hear his own court hearing about what's going to happen to him and his family? And then the most ludicrous thing of all is what would have happened if, and which did happen in the middle of that hearing, the landlord suddenly made some point I wasn't expecting, and started raising some complaint I didn't know about. In essence, we were asking Mr. Curlew, who was not the most digitally savvy person, while staring at the poor phone and having playing through the speakers, to open the chat function maybe and sort of type some message in that I could see and the other side couldn't see. And that just was never, ever going to happen. So I do have to say that, you know, we've had a lot of online hearings during COVID and still to some extent today. And in some cases they're all right, but often they're just really not great.
And I think something that you're highlighting in your book was that there is potential for that to become the new normal. Does that worry you at all?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's all sorts of fantastic schemes for online courts to sell off more court buildings. For example, the most beautiful court building in London, I know that shouldn't count for anything, but you know, it does a bit, is the City of Mayor's Court. And that's currently up in line to be sold off next. Every time they sell off the building, it becomes redeveloped as flats. And that money, in theory, could pay to go over to pay for the digital infrastructure for all our new online courts. And it's just hearing centre by hearing centre, they're closing. And the distances people have to travel, even without the online courts, where hearings are still taking place. You know, now it's not the courts 30 minutes from where you live and it's one bus ride away. Now it's an hour and it's three bus rides away. And then we're seeing that in terms of people not engaging with court and just the whole system slowly, bit by bit, falling apart.
And what kind of impact does that have on justice? You know, if we're talking about a system here that's bit by bit falling apart, if, you know, tomorrow somebody's facing eviction and they're facing losing their home, what's going to happen to them?
Well, the practical reality is they'll lose their home. And the practical reality is a portion of them, and I gave the example of Ronald, will be people who've got, who are disabled, who've got very serious illnesses, who are quite old, and who just wouldn't be able to survive on the streets for any length of time at all. There was a great piece of research which came out just a couple of weeks ago done by Maeve McClenachan and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And they looked at how long the average court hearing takes, which results in someone losing the possession of their home. And the average is less than 5 minutes. They describe cases where people were losing their homes in less than 1 minute. And given the importance of the issues, you know, think about some of the cases I've talked about already, you know, like, for example, the Curleys, they've got a disabled kid in the household. If they're evicted from their home for antisocial behaviour, no one else is going to rehouse that family. That's going to be causing knock-on impacts on social care, on all sorts of knock-on effects for decades after that decision is taken. And it shouldn't be something that's taken in a few minutes.
So what kind of alternative do you think would work better?
Okay, wow. Some of the things which have happened, which I think are exciting. During COVID, there was a really big shift towards people setting up tenants' unions. So people who rent, getting together, sharing information, sharing legal knowledge, working together to making sure that people weren't evicted. I thought that was really positive. Clearly, during COVID, it's brought to light that there's certain kinds of ways in which people get possession, and those need to be slowed down. The big headline one is Section 21. I'm not going to go into it, take too long to explain, but just to say that is something which the government has been saying now for 3 years. They're going to repeal and abolish. Well, they need to actually do it. And there are others too, in terms of another one's called Grand Aid. But behind all of these things, we could talk about the changes to benefits and how bit by bit they're putting more and more people in the situation where they can't afford their rent. Basically, they're five or six key legal reforms, which everyone in the housing world knows and which could be enacted and would make the difference. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I've sort of given a flavour of them. They would change things. They would help.
And talking of housing benefit, I actually wanted to kind of read back to you what you wrote in your book about that, because I thought it was such an interesting argument. So you're actually kind of questioning the fundamental purpose of this benefit, and arguing that the purpose of the benefit is no longer to protect the tenant, but rather to subsidise the landlord and to sustain house prices generally. When in 2019, the housing benefit bill amounted to £22 billion, half of which went to private landlords, this is a huge amount of money. Can you explain to us a little bit about how housing benefit works and why you feel this benefit has kind of changed purpose in this really dramatic way?
Okay. How housing benefit used to work was that someone who couldn't afford to pay their own rent, maybe because they were on other benefits too, would come along, and in those days it was paid by the local authority. And in the vast majority of cases, it just simply paid whatever the 100% rent was that person had to pay. So there are other benefits, income support, job seekers allowance, were to pay for their food, but housing benefit was to pay for their rent. Now, it started going up really fast for a whole bunch of reasons. Rise in London house prices, the realisation amongst landlords that you could take a medium-sized house, break it down into smaller and smaller units, have people living, maybe 20 of them in a house, get people who were essentially likely to be homeless, get them in, put them through housing benefit, charge effectively as much rent as you like. So that, you know, there are people working that scam as landlords who, frankly, are taking single units. I've seen properties where a home in the suburbs, originally four or five bedrooms, now a lot more, and those landlords are turning over £200,000 a year in housing benefit. Now, that's had an impact in terms of the result of that is that housing benefit is now an absolutely huge bill. It's such a very large part of total welfare budget. What the government did under austerity, and people may remember David Cameron, George Osborne, I know this feels like 100 years ago, but basically what they did is they made four or five changes to housing benefit to try and reduce the expenditure on it. But none of them targeted landlords, they all targeted tenants. So they said, for example, you know, if someone's living by themselves, they couldn't have more than the total amount of housing benefit, and so on and so on and so on. And they've all created a situation where the housing benefit bill is just as large as it ever was, but there are lots and lots of tenants who getting housing benefit or a successful universal credit and can't afford to pay their rent. And somehow we need to just reverse the whole direction of those cuts. It shouldn't be, it shouldn't be about penalising tenants. It should be, to some extent, about going after these landlords who've got 20, 30, 200 properties and saying, actually, we don't need to subsidise you to the extent that you're milking this system.
So in your book, you mention one particularly memorable landlord called Mr. Panayi, who you say earns more from his rental business than many chief executives of major banks earn. Can you tell us a little bit more about his story and how he came to be in this position?
Mr. Panayi is a lovely guy. He owns a lot of properties along Islington's Caledonian Road, and he is definitely a bit of a personality in the area. I mean, I don't live that far away from him, or certainly from the homes he rents out. He has been notorious over many years. There have been TV documentaries about him, all sorts of things. The most famous thing he ever did was he started building these homes under Caledonian Road, which, you know, just imagine a London north running road with shops on both sides and tower blocks behind them. And he started building these homes under the ground, tunnelling these homes, which had no natural light. And this just was a huge scandal. He's been investigated by all sorts of people. The council know him, know what he's up to, been determined to bring him to the book. But, you know, the one thing I did for my book, because a lot of that story is in the public domain, you know, lots of newspapers have written about it. The one thing I did, which was a bit different, is I just looked up his company accounts and tried to work out how much he's making. And it's something like 500 properties. And the truth is, he turns over a profit on them because he's not spending a lot of money on repairs. He turns over more of a profit, as you say, than all bar six or seven chief executives of the largest FTSE 100 companies. You know, there are very few people who work for him. It's just all profit. And it's a real sign of how absolutely upside down our system is, that people who just simply are profiting on that scale are able to make such an enormous amount of money.
And what would you have government do to kind of combat that massive inequality?
Well, one of the ideas I've been talking about, it's not something I particularly talk about in the book, one thing I've been talking about, and look, this is a bit of a radical theory, you know, maybe the reason I didn't put it in the book is maybe it's a bit out there. But one of the ideas I've been thinking about is, couldn't we have something like a maximum rent? Couldn't we actually say, you know, we've got a minimum wage, and the minimum wage basically turns around and says, right, you know, £7.50 an hour or whatever it is, times 40 hours, there's a limit on how much you can earn on the minimum wage. And why don't we calculate a maximum rent based on that? You know, someone on the minimum wage shouldn't be expected to pay more than £100 per room per week or whatever the figures are. I'm not particularly tied to a particular one, but I'm just saying, if there is a rent which does not go up, then the people who'd really notice it are those ones who are treating housing like a factory condition, you know, treating other human beings like we're factory hens, frankly. And they wouldn't be able to make the super, super profits they're making out of them. That just shouldn't happen.
Moving into the courtroom, you kind of mentioned that the kind of duality that exists for you personally as a lawyer, in that you're kind of speaking to the judge in a really legal language, and there's a lot of sort of old boys kind of traditions around the legal system, but then you're representing clients who are not familiar with that world at all and who might feel quite distant from it. How do you deal with that tension of, you know, existing in this highly formalistic and traditional world, representing clients who are not moving in those parameters?
Well, the first thing you need to fit in is what's the relationship between them and me? And when I do housing, I'm a legal aid lawyer. That means I'm representing people on legal aid. So they're people who really don't have a lot of money. Basically, you can only get legal aid these days effectively if you're on benefits. So I'm representing the people who are the poorest set of tenants out there. And in truth, I guess I suppose I play up to that. You know, I'm someone who came from a relatively affluent and privileged background myself. I often find when I'm in court that some of the judges, they'll sort of give me a bit of a look as if to say, you know, you've got to understand it from my point of view, because Mr. Renton, everyone in this room knows that in 5 years or in 10 years time, you're going to be sat on the same side of this desk as I am now, and you're going to be dealing with these nightmare tenants, and you're going to be dealing with these nightmare landlords. And, you know, you've got to see it from my point of view. And the truth is, I suppose I play up to that a bit. I certainly don't hide from that or, you know, I don't know, pretend to be something different. But it's not just about me. It's really about the clients. And I think the main thing that I'm doing, that I'm trying to explain in the book, is how I think you represent people with integrity. And it's just about conveying the totality of people's situations. You know, I mean, just to give an example, yeah. A lot of my cases are about disrepair, and they're about waters falling in and the tenants in terrible situation. And some barristers don't really like those cases because they're just about money. Why on earth would you fight about money, even for a tenant who's on benefits? And I was in a case on Friday, and the tenant said to me, he was talking about what it was like being in a room, and he's been there for 2 years, and rain's been coming in, and the landlord's not repaired the roof in all that time. And he started talking to me about the water coming in, the drip. And I said, well, you know, like, when it's raining, it must be really bad. He says, it's not just when it's raining. You know, you realise that the tempo of the water changes depending on the intensity of the rain outside. Sometimes it's really hard and fast. It means really hard and fast in his room in which he lives and sleeps. And that's just my job. My job is to have absolutely no fear about saying that to the judge, about forcing them to confront the reality of my client's situations. That, you know, because I'm a bit of a posh boy, because I am someone who's kind of an insider, therefore taking that freedom and not holding back and saying all of it and explaining all of it. And if I think the judge has got as any feeling in the judge's mind, they might make a decision which isn't favourable to my client, then forcing the judge, making it as difficult for them as possible to do that, and making them confront the reality of the lives of my clients lead.
And would you ever move to the other side of the fence and become a judge?
No. I don't know. I think I'm a bit of a lefty, and I think it's very difficult to do that, to be both. And I think, as you know, but again, precisely because I wouldn't do both, again, that means that when I look at judges, I try to feel a lot of respect for them. You know, the good judges, it's a bit like, I don't know if, you know, this is probably a ludicrous example to think of, but I don't know if you remember that fantasy series that went on forever, the biggest grossing TV series of all time. The word's gone out of my head. Song of Fire and Ice.
Not Lord of the Rings.
No, George R.R. Martin.
Oh, not The Hunger Games.
No, but you know the one I mean.
Oh my gosh, I do know the one you mean.
This is embarrassing.
It is.
Anyway, there's a moment.
It's Game of Thrones.
Right. There's a moment at Game of Thrones. So, like, there's a senior moment for you, everyone listening. Anyway, there's a moment at Game of Thrones that starts where Jon Snow's there and he's got to kill someone. It's the first episode, and he's got his son. He's trying to explain to him the integrity of some of the rules and makes decisions. So, look, if you're going to make a decision that someone's going to lose their life, you've got to be the one who executes them, because it's going to be hard for you. And again, that's kind of my attitude towards judges. If they're willing to actually make the decision, if they're willing to look my client in the eye when they're saying something which is unfavourable to my client, then I respect them. Because it's not easy. It's a tough thing they've got to do. And there are good judges. And a good judge is not simply about, you know, doing what I want. A good judge is about behaving with integrity, even when you do something which I or my clients don't want.
That's a very, very diplomatic and important point. So I just want to kind of zoom out now and take a more bird's eye view on the housing crisis, and look at a view that you put forward in your book, which is that Labour lost the general election in 2017 and 2019, partly because they weren't able to illustrate to voters and show voters that while tenants and landlords have competing interests, the same is not true of tenants and homeowners. What do you mean by this?
I think the point I was trying to make wasn't so much tenants and homeowners, but homeowners and landlords. That's really the distinction which has never been brought out. Okay, how I try and put it like this, and this is a bit of a complex argument, so I'll try and do it as quickly as I can. When you look back at Jeremy Corbyn, his whole success as a politician seems to be he spoke to the young people, I spoke to young people, particularly who rented. If you look at the polls on how people were going to vote in the 2017 and 2019 elections by what kind of home they lived in, whether they owned it or whether they rented, there was a huge majority of tenants pro Corbyn. And they felt like he was speaking their situation. So then why did he lose? And the reason why he lost, it seems to me, is because actually most people in Britain aren't tenants. More people own their own home. So somehow you've got to get, if you're going to have progressive politics around housing, somehow you need to have a majority. And that majority has got to involve some homeowners. And I think some of that is about talking about generations. You know, it may be that you're a homeowner, maybe you're in your 50s or 60s, and maybe thinking, what on earth do I need to hear about tenants? You know, that's not my situation. I've not been there for 20 or 30 years. But if you've got kids or grandkids, how do you think they're going to live? You know, if you've got one home in the family, you cannot pass that down from generation to generation to generation to fill up all the people as it goes down. You can't. Or you know, you can't do it till your kids are 50 or 60 themselves. So it's no use. So somehow we have to have an idea that those homeowners who are saving up all their money, who think they're putting money aside so their kids can pay for a deposit. Kids don't need a deposit. What the kids need is a bit of housing justice now. So it's that sense of generational justice. And then once you start focusing on that, then you also get an idea that some of the people I was talking about earlier, those big landlords, are a major obstacle to tenant justice. You know, I am never going to say a bad word for a landlord who's got, they've got their own home and they rent out a room and someone's lodging with them. I'm never going to say a bad word about a landlord who's got their own home and they literally, whatever, they've inherited a house from their parents and they only have one house and that's all they let out. If they make some mistakes, I'm not going to criticise them. I get where they might have some difficulty. They're not the people I come across in my cases. The people I come across in my cases are these people who are hoarding hundreds and hundreds of homes, taking out vast profits and doing very little work, very little repairs. They're the people I say that, you know, if we focus on them, then you can get to see homeowners to see that they have different interests from landlords.
And finally, David Renton, I just want to ask you if there's a case in housing that sticks with you.
One single housing case. Okay. The case I quote most in my judgments is a case called Akerman and Livingston. And it's all about what do you do when someone's disabled, so they're protected by the Equality Act, and they might have to lose their home. And it was just a brilliant decision from Baroness Hill, because it just talked about how things change once you get the Equality Act involved. Now, you know, I'm talking about disabled tenants. This would be true if someone's threatened with losing their home because they were black, because they were Irish. If they're threatened with losing their home because they're women, it could be any different reason. But she just talks through in a really practical way about how landlords have to deal with that. And it's just, I don't know, maybe I should have brought it in quote summary because some of the individual sections, it's just poetry. But it is just a really lovely example. And it's one of those really rare things, you know, probably everyone listening to this remembers Baroness Hales. You know, she was the woman with the spider brooch at the time of Brexit. And she was quite a funny old judge. She hadn't judged for that long when she got promoted to the Court of Appeal to the Supreme Court. She'd actually been an academic. And there are very, very few judges who become academics. But one thing she understood in dozens of cases, and the one I brought along is Akerman and Livingston today, but it could be lots of others, was she just understood what it's like when people are in need, when women are in need, when people, families are in need, when people are in need and threatened to losing their home. And it just puts a bit of a sort of tank trap in the way of landlords who are trying to force people out too quickly. So yeah, that would be my case.
Thank you so much, David, for joining us on the podcast today. You can read Anna Minton's review of David Renton's book, Jobs and Homes, on our website. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do leave us a rating and a review. Goodbye, stay safe, and see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.